Class is death. Dun, 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 dun. So we're completing the life cycle here this evening with the happiest of topics. but I want to get into this because I want to start with this. I want to discuss the mitzvah of burial, okay, which is probably the essence of death in Judaism. Is that we have a mitzvah to be buried, and we have, as opposed to cremation. So why is that so important? Right, that's a very important Jewish ideal. Why is that so important? Right.
Well, one thing is that the way my dad said to me, if you are cremating, the body shrinks and it sits up.
What does that mean?
And that's not the way it's supposed to be.
Okay, so you're going Kabbalistic on us a little bit.
This is what I was told.
Okay. Well, let's get into some of the sources that talk about this. I gave a class on this a couple years ago at a conference for, what's it called? For,
young people. Orphans. Widows.
That's not helping. For Chevra Kedisha, there is a program, it's a national program, they meet every year for Chevra Kedisha and Jewish funeral homes. It's a fun group. And it's a very nice group. And it was in the Bay Area a couple of years ago, and they asked me to have a class on why does Judaism prefer burial over cremation? Because there's a rising tide in cremation. In Jewish circles, especially in Reform circles, and the Reform rabbi who spoke, Rabbi Pierce, who's the head rabbi at Emmanuel, so he spoke as well, and he spoke out against cremation, and then said that probably about 50% of those who passed away who members of Emmanuel are cremated. So that's the percent, about 50%. And there's all sorts of reasons that are given.
Wasn't it because we need our bodies when the Mashiach comes in?
Yeah, so then we'll get to that, yeah. That's a fair reason. This is a growing issue in the Jewish community, and something that used to be a given, that, you know, a lot of the things that a generation or two ago, people would say, well, Jews don't do that, and everyone was, you know, okay with that, and it was like the end of the conversation. So those aren't the case anymore. A lot of those things are just not true. I mean, Jews are starting to do that, you know, and cremation is one of those things. So let's get into the sources. Page 11. So when Adam is created, how is Adam created? So if you look at doing Hebrew and English, Pasuk Zion, verse 7. Vayitzar Hashem Elohim et Adam afar min ha'adamah, vayipach bi'apav nishmat chayim, vayihi ha'adam l'nefesh chaya. And Hashem, God, formed the man of dust from the ground, and he blew into his nostrils the soul of life, and man became a living being. So, we have here a concept that that Adam was created from the ground. Okay, now why is Adam created from the ground as opposed to just from thin air? How were the animals created? Right, were the animals created from the ground? Right, doesn't say that. Right, we don't. Now, if there's any mention of giraffes or birds or any other animals being created from the ground, they're created, right? However they're created, however you want to understand the
abracadabra,
or is it evolution, or some sort of combination, whatever it is. However you fall out on the creationism evolution discussion, which, you know, that's a class for another time. Whatever happened, according to the Torah's account, right, there's no mention of being created from the ground. However, human beings are created from the ground. Our bodies are created from the ground, and then a soul is breathed into us. Okay? So, there's a very strong connection between us and the land. Right? The human body, the human being, and the ground, and the land, there's a very strong connection between the two. We are, so to speak, in a, joined at the hip. And, so, the most basic idea of burial is a returning to our source, right? That's the most basic idea. We are returning to where we came from, to where we were created.
Dust to dust.
Dust to dust, exactly. And that's a very, you know, strong pull here. So Rashi says on this pasuk, Hashem collected from the ground of the four corners of the earth, so wherever a person might die, the ground is fit for burial. So it wasn't just that Adam was created in the Garden of Eden and the ground there was used. Hashem takes dust from all over the world, combines it into one, so somehow the human being is connected to the entire world. Right? Wherever you are in the world, it is fit for burial. You're not limited to one place. Okay, so that's number one. Source number two. Let's go to page 19. So in Hebrew, we're going to do verse 19, Yotet. So, b'seyata pecha tochal lechem ad shivcha el hadama ki mimena lukachta ki afarata velafarta shuv. By the sweat of your brow shall you eat bread until you return to the ground from which you were taken. For you are dust, and to dust shall you return. So, you can't get more clear than that, that this is the Jewish concept. That we come from the ground, and then we return to the ground. Why do you think this is so important? Hey, why do you think this is so important? Why the stress on we came from the ground, once it goes back to the ground, why does that matter so much?
Because the body goes back to the ground, but our soul go back to God.
Okay, so that's good. So it differentiates our body and soul. Then maybe to a certain extent, if you if a body is cremated, it almost seems like it's going the way of the soul. It's disappearing. It's, you know, there's no there there. It's almost, it becomes ephemeral.
Yeah, but you get dust over there too.
That's no, like, I know, but when if you go to a funeral and there's a body in a casket, there's something about, you know, the discrepancy between the lifeless body and the body full of life is just so stark.
Yeah,
you know, it's shocking, and that it shocks me every time I go to a funeral, just knowing that in that casket there is a body, and I knew that person, and I remember that person living, and now the body is just there, limp. I mean, to me, it sends the message: what creates the person is the soul. Yeah. Right? Not to get too depressing or anything, but like, you can't do class.
That's awful.
You can't do class on death. No, but I think it's an important point: is that it really sends the message.
You should invite the Muslims; they would love this class.
Yeah. Send them the link.
Who would have loved it? Muslims.
Yeah. Well, let's say bring up Obama this time. Obama's later. So to me, that contrast is very strong and very poignant, right? That we are going from, when you bury the body, it sends the message that the body without the soul has no life, and that ultimately our bodies are just physicality, pure physicality, and it sends a message to the living. Right? I think the message to the living is very strong. A funeral is supposed to be a time of reflection. Right? There is no time a person is more reflective, more honest with themselves than at a funeral. Right? You know, because you have no choice. I think it's in Kohelis it says, right, that better to go to funerals than to weddings. Because when you go to a funeral, you have no choice but to to stare your mortality in the face. And if that does, you know, if that doesn't spur you to action, to change, to want to be a better person, you know, nothing else will. So you miss all that with cremation, right? You miss all of that. You miss that. So it seems that here Hashem is, as Tommy's saying, Hashem is really sending us the message: never forget that your bodies came from the ground and will return to the ground. Because you're supposed to look at your bodies as pure physicality and not your essence, right? So we want to send that message to people over and over again, right? It's a constant reminder. Yeah.
But what I don't understand, I have gone to Sinai. Somebody whom I know very older gentleman passed away, and I took it naturally to go to the cemetery.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I didn't want to go to the following the cars, so I went to the cemetery.
Okay.
And there was nobody there.
I don't understand what happened.
But from Sinai, they went somewhere else to cremate this person.
Oh, they did.
Yeah.
Okay.
And boy, was I shocked.
Yeah. It's happening more and more. It is a little shocking. Now we have a lot of references in Bereishis of people being buried, right? For example, number one, I'll just read to you outside, right? Avram, right? Avram buries Sarah, and the Torah has a whole chapter discussing Avram buying the burial plot for Sarah, the Marat Machpelah, which is still used today. Rachel dies, and she's buried, right? The Torah says, thus Rachel died, was buried on the road to Ephrat, which is Bethlehem. Jacob set up a monument over her grave. It is the monument of Rachel's grave until today. Very clear. It's burial is, it goes back all the way to Adam, right? To Adam and Eve, and to the first Jews. Again, very clearly part of who they were. Source number 3. This is Ethics of the Sages from Pirkei Avot, chapter 3, Mishnah 1. Akiva ben Mehalel said, keep your eye on 3 things and you will not come to sin. Know where you came from, where you are going, and before whom you will eventually give an accounting of your life. Where did you come from? From an insignificant drop. Where are you going? To a place full of dirt, maggots, and worms. Before whom will you eventually give an accounting of your life? Before Hashem, the King of Kings. Okay? You know, this is the ultimate way, like we said, to keep a person in check, to give a person perspective, is to remind them, you know, the biggest trick that the Yetzirah plays on us is it takes away perspective, right? It makes us feel immortal, right? That's the biggest, the most effective trick the Yetzirah have on us. It makes us feel immortal. We know we're not, but we're so bothered by thinking that way. It's so disturbing for us to think about it that we'd rather pretend like it's not true, right? And even though all the evidence is against us, right, we still predominantly live our life with the assumption that we are immortal, right? It's the greatest tool the Yetzer Hara really seems to have, and so we have to remind ourselves of our mortality. By reminding ourselves of immortality, it reminds us not to waste our time, not to live life too frivolously. And so, you know, the way he puts it is, you know, where are you going? You're going to a place full of dirt, right? You think that what you're doing now is so important. You think that that your physicality is going to define you, that your wealth is going to define you, that that's going to be your ultimate success. Just realize, you know, where that's going to get you in the end. Right? It's not going to get you anywhere. And so this, you know, that message is really integral to Judaism. Okay. Now we have a very strong concept of showing honor to the deceased, okay, one of the most important mitzvah that we have is showing honor to the deceased. And it's considered to be, you know, the mitzvah that trumps all mitzvahs. The mitzvah that, if you're ever in conflict between two things, this is always the first thing you do, is something called mace mitzvah. Okay? If there's a body that needs to be buried and it's not being attended to, then, or if it's your responsibility to take care of someone's burial, then that trumps everything else you could do. There's nothing else more important than that. And so we show such respect to the human body. So there's a few different places in the Torah where this comes out. Number one, in Devarim 21. Page 1049. Okay. So verse 22. If a man shall have committed a sin, whose judgment is death, he shall be put to death, and you shall hang him on a gallows. His body shall not remain for the night on the gallows, rather you shall surely bury him on that day. For a hanging person is a curse of God, and you shall not contaminate your land, which Hashem your God gives you as an inheritance. So, it is seen that even in a situation where someone is sent, commits a sin that deserves the death penalty, they get the death penalty, and they're hung, and again, this is very infrequently would ever happen. So there's a prohibition of letting the body remain there at night. That even someone who's done something that deserves the death penalty, we still show them the basic respect of burial. Okay? And you're not allowed to just let the body hang there, it's seen as disrespectful. And human life is ultimately, you know, in God's hands. And, you know, just like in an American law, that once a case is murder, right, it's now the state's case. It's no longer, you know, it's not the family's case. Right? It's, you know, if someone commits murder, it's the state versus Charles Manson. Right? It's not the family of the victim versus Charles Manson. Why? Because the state is compelled to protect human life. And so Hashem is saying that ultimately every person is my creation, you know, on loan in this world. And so you have to show respect. And so there's a number of different ways that we're told to show the human body respect. Ours and other people's, right? For example, a tattoo. So the reason you're not supposed to have a tattoo, or you're not supposed to cut your body in a permanent way,
mark your body
in a permanent way, is part of it is to show you that your body is not your own, right? We assume that this is my body, I can do what I want with it. But it's not true. You know, your body is not your own. Your body is something that Hashem lends you during your lifetime to use. You know, it lends your soul something to inhabit this world, but ultimately it's not yours. Yeah, and that's so we're supposed to look at all people that way, and that a person, no matter who they are, after they've passed away, they deserve equal respect as anybody else. So there's a source in Amos, one of the later prophets, second chapter, verse 1, goes like this: "Thus said Hashem, for three transgressions of Moab I have looked away, but for four I will not pardon them, for they're burning the bones of the king of Edom into lime." That the cruelty they showed to the human body was seen as the that was the thing that Hashem said that's unforgivable. And there's a crazy source here. This is in the Talmud Sanhedrin 82a. This is how the story goes. Rabbi Chiya said to Bar Avuha, said, "It was written on the skull of Jehoiakim, this and still another." That's the Jewish king Jehoiakim. the grandfather of Rabbi Pereda found a certain skull that was cast down at the gates of Jerusalem, and upon it it was written this and still another. He buried it, but it broke forth from the ground. So Rabbi Chiya said, this is the skull of Jehoiakim. Concerning who it was written, he shall be buried with the burial of a donkey, dragged and cast beyond the gates of Jerusalem. He said to himself, Jehoiakim is still a king, and is not proper conduct to disgrace him further. So he took Jehoiakim's skull, wrapped it in silk, and placed it in a box. Later his wife came home and saw the skull and told her neighbors what she saw. They said to her, this is surely the skull of your husband's first wife, whom he cannot forget. So she heated up the oven and burned the skull inside. What?
Would that count as the shatara?
Yeah, that's pretty bad. Yeah, I think so.
They don't have any...
Motzi Shemra?
It's not true.
It's Motzi Shemra. It's even worse in some ways because it's made up. Lashon Hara, you're saying that's true, but you're saying it anyway. And when you make something out, that's Motzi Shemra. That's.
Well, I don't think they're making it up on purpose. Sorry, maybe we're getting off topic.
Well, they're making. I mean, they don't really know this is what his intentions were, or this is what he was feeling, right? Or this is what he thought of his first wife, right? Don't even know what skull this is. let alone what he's thinking.
Well, they think they do, or was it just malicious to begin with?
Well, you know, it's clearly slander. It's clearly slander in some way. Yeah, I mean, how helpful is this to anybody, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So she heated up the oven and burned the skull inside. When her husband came home, he said, this is what was written on the skull, this curse and still another. I mean, this was the second curse that Jehoiakim, for his sins, the greatest punishment he got was that he was, his body was disgraced. And so, the original disgrace is that he wasn't buried properly and that his body was still floating around. And, you know, miraculously, Hashem would not let his skull be buried. The ultimate sign of disrespect was that it was going to get burned. That's something that, yeah. So it shows that the ultimate sign of disrespect to a body is to burn it. Right? To burn a body seems the ultimate sign of disrespect. It's as if it's, you know, meaningless. Right? So Judaism looks at a cremation as being... It's an insult to the person. Right? It's an insult. It's seen as, you know, you're not worthy of being buried in the ground. You're not worthy of respect. Right? You're going to have a, we're going to burn your bodies as if you've never existed. So this is a source that shows the ultimate sign of disrespect is being burned. Yeah.
Well, what question I have? All these things, when the Torah was done or written,
right,
there were other nations who they honored their heroes or kings by burning them.
Oh, for sure.
Like the Greeks did it.
The Vikings.
Oh, yeah.
The Vikings did that, they burned bodies?
Oh, Vikings.
You see that in Star Wars too.
Well,
Luke burns Darth Vader's body.
Yeah.
He made Darth Vader.
You can read the proof from that.
No, there's no proof from that.
The Hindus, and supposedly the Hindus have done many of their teaching is similar to the Jewish teaching.
Do they bury? I don't know.
They burn.
They burn. Look, I'm not saying this is for everyone. We're not saying that this is a universal concept. We're saying... This is the Jewish perspective.
Yeah.
Okay. This is the Jewish perspective. and so this is how Judaism looks at it. Do other cultures look at it differently? Clearly. But, you know.
Well,
we can bring in a Hindu to teach their perspective on it. Okay. So there's a source here, the Shulchan Aruch, that says... That if someone passes away, so you're not supposed to move the body if you can help it until after Shabbos. If they die on Shabbos, you're supposed to. We just had this in our community. Someone died on Shabbos. You're supposed to ideally wait until after Shabbos if possible. The body's considered muktzah. It's not something you really want to can't really do on Shabbos. However, you're allowed to move the body if something bad could happen to it. If it could be damaged or something, you know, something could go wrong. So you're allowed to move the body. So it's just a sign that when it comes to other areas of Jewish law, you know, showing respect to body will always take precedence. So here's another interesting source. This is from the Rambam, Maimonides, Laws of Mourning, chapter 12, verse 1. A eulogy is for the honor of the deceased. Therefore, the Beit Din forces the descendants to pay for a professional eulogizer. So it used to be that there were specialists who all they did was give eulogies. Right? There wasn't rabbis who would give versus weddings and funerals. There was just people who did funerals. That was their job. Right? They worked for the cemetery, whatever it was. So let's say you had a family, and the kids are cheap. Right? They don't want to pay this guy. We'll do a ceremony. We don't need to pay some professional to do it. We'll just do something simple. Right? We'll bury our parent, respectfully. But the extra money to pay some professional to get there and speak, that's not an expense that we feel that we need to incur. So, Beit Din, who is handling the estate, right? But they're handling the estate. After a person dies, the court handles the estate. So, they compel them to pay for a professional to give the eulogy, right? Because it's for the honor of the deceased, and they don't have a right to forego the honor of the deceased unless they themselves had wanted the honor to be foregone, right? But if the deceased decreed while they were alive not to be eulogized, then we don't do a eulogy. Right? So you have the right to say, I don't want a eulogy for myself when I pass away. That you can do, but if you don't declare that in your lifetime, your descendants, your inheritors cannot make that decision for you. Okay? But if the person decrees not to bury them, let's say somebody says, I don't want to be buried, then we don't listen to them. Because burial is a mitzvah, as it says, rather you shall surely bury him on that day, right? That's from the case of the person who was hung. So, it's seen as not even a person's choice. According to Jewish law, even if a person writes a will and says clearly, I don't want to be buried, and I've gotten questions like this, you can go against the will of the person who passes away.
That's the book I gave
according
you.
To Jewish law. What?
That's the book I gave you, Avner Weiss.
Yeah, talks about it, yeah. So that's according to Jewish law, you have every right to do so. And you might even have a mitzvah to do so. So it's certainly prohibited to burn a Jewish body. So why is this so? So we gave a few other reasons. Number one, because didn't turn that off. Sorry about that.
Tehillah.
It is not tehillah. Mm-hmm. No. It's only Sunday morning, my kids call. Okay. Because by doing this, you'll have nullified a positive mitzvah. As the Torah says, rather you shall surely bury him on that day. And it doesn't matter if you have the ashes, even if you're supposed to bury the ashes, right? It's a whole discussion, should you bury the ashes? You are no longer able to fulfill the mitzvah of burial. Number two, it's prohibited to burn a human body. So summarize, number one, there's a positive mitzvah to bury. Number two, there seems to be a disgrace to the body by not burying. Okay. So here there's a source from the Achiezer. The Achiezer was Chaim Ozer Grudzinski, who was known as the Dayan of Vilna. He lived from 1863 to 1940, and was one of the leading rabbis of his era. So this is what he writes. According to the Beit Yitzchak, who was Rabbi Yitzchak Shmalkes, the head of the rabbinical court of Paramishle, I don't have my geography down about that one, the essence is that the mitzvah of burial is something our great ancestors have involved themselves in, and one who buries their deceased has faith in Tchias HaMeitim, the coming to life of the dead. And one who burns a body, it's as if they deny Hashem's ability to bring back the dead. I mean, that's something that Mario mentioned from the beginning, that's one of the issues here, is that we believe in the concept that Hashem can bring back the dead in the times of Mashiach. How that works, what that means, that's a whole other conversation. But it's one of the 13 things that the Rambam says are part of the 13 principles of faith. And so, so by burning a body, you're basically saying, we don't think that that can happen. We don't believe in it anymore. And so that's, he said, that's part of the issue as well. So, in 1891, the Reform Movement, this is towards the beginning of the Reform Movement, was given this question. What's their opinion on cremation versus burial? So this is what they wrote. Though some might have considered the burying of the dead merely as a minhag, a custom, not as a mitzvah, it is certain that this minhag was very deeply rooted and was consecrated in the consciousness of the people. And such a minhag, such as unwritten law, is, according to very ancient Jewish legal principles, superior to the written law as even and even supersedes it. Sometimes a custom becomes so part of who we are that you don't change it. It is further certain that since the 8th century, all authorities, without exception, agree that burial is one of the 613 commandments of the Torah. The first one who specified the 613 commandments was Rabbi Shimon of Korea, and in his enumeration of the same included also Likvor Tamatim. So that's the thing, it's the Halachos Gedolos. So it's a very, even the Reform Movement was very clear, this is Jewish law, at the very least, a custom, but something that's become, that most commentaries agree upon the 613 mitzvot, and there's not a lot to discuss about. There's not a lot to discuss about it. Now, any questions before we move on to some other things?
Well, that's what today is, that is, you know, being the more mature person in the room, I have seen a lot of people telling one thing, and just before they die, or they get very old, they change their mind very fast. Like, in Budapest, somebody buried in the back is buried because over there is cheap. So just before they die, usually they say, "Don't put me on all the way back." Or somebody says, "I want to be cremated all their life," and just before they say, "Bury me."
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Very interesting, that part.
But so you've seen people say, people want to be cremated, they change their mind to burial. Did you?
Yeah.
But you ever saw the reverse?
No.
Never saw the reverse.
No.
Yeah, I would think. I don't know. Psychologically.
I don't know. Yeah. People have fun.
You know what? When you know, like, again, when you really face your mortality, you know, your perspective changes.
Yeah.
You know? And there gets to be a point in your life, at the very end, when you have no choice but to face it.
Yeah.
You know?
Then you change your mind.
Yeah. Well, that's why there's a Jewish law that anything someone says in the deathbed is taken to be truth. Right? You don't lie then. Yeah. You don't lie then.
See, Rabbi.
Yeah.
Has the use of caskets always been custom?
Not necessarily.
No.
No, not necessarily. So. No, there's been times when it's not been the custom. Or at least it's been, you know, there's been...
Isn't it in Israel when you buried in the mountain over there?
Yeah, there's...
They just put you in a white cloth, no?
Yep. Yeah, even today in Jerusalem, in certain cemeteries, they just bury. They wrap a person in a cloth and they just bury them, yeah. I mean, it's pretty standard. You know, all aspects of burial are supposed to be done as simply as possible. So, the casket is supposed to be made out of wood and nothing else. The shrouds a person is buried in is supposed to be simple and universal.
It's not Shabbos garb.
What?
It's not Shabbos garb.
It's a very simple white, like, linen garment. It's very simple and it's universal. The idea is that, you know, they never wanted funerals to be, they wanted to be respectful, but not expensive or not cost debilitating for people. So you're not supposed to have above ground, what's it called?
Tombstones.
Like mausoleums, yeah. Tombstones are also supposed to be simple.
Or can't be the cemetery, there are some of them.
There shouldn't be.
Yeah, cool.
There are, but there shouldn't be. If you go to, you know, there's a few different cemeteries here, you know, in the area. So there's Eternal Home, which is the more traditional one where we have our section. They have, right? Not in our section.
I remember in Hungary, it's an old cemetery, very old.
Yeah.
And they have mausoleum.
Yeah, and look, there's people who've done it, but you're not supposed to do it. Okay. Yeah. There's some cities where you have to do it, right? Like New Orleans. In New Orleans, they can't bury it in the ground. The water level is too high. So that's different. I mean, that's just different. Although, if you go to Israel, you'll see a lot of places where the burial sites were in caves. And they would dig, like, you know, into the cave, and then they would have, like, these... there's a word for it. There's a word for it that you, like, bury the person in, you know, they have, like almost like bunk, like bunks, you know. It's like there's a different word for it. It's not bunks, but so the people.
It's a hole in the hole.
What? It's what?
A hole in the wall.
A hole in the wall. Yeah, it's a hole in the mountain. There's different ways to be buried into the ground, but it's supposed to be simple. It's not supposed to be extravagant, and you see that today. I mean, people there's sometimes out of the desire to respect. You know, to show respect, people want to have big, impressive, expensive, you know, mausoleums or plots or stones or whatever.
Represent you are a very rich person.
It does, but yeah, I think, yeah, some people feel if they have the money, they want to show the respect. You know, I mean, I think it's most of them coming from the right place. I don't think people want to. As far as places to show off their money, I don't think that's a place people really are, like, you know, taking people to show it off their money. I think they can do it, so they want to do it, you know. And you almost feel guilty not, you know, by being cheap here. So, and sometimes we don't want people to be cheap where, you know, they don't hire the person to do the eulogy or pay the rabbi appropriately in modern times. But,
If this law goes for... Swardis too, or
yeah, this is universal.
This is the universal.
Yeah.
And another question: can a body can be buried and dug up and put it somewhere else?
In extreme situations, it's not. It's really.
And you're supposed to be you bury someone and.
You're not. Yeah, you're not. I mean, you dig it up if it's. If it's dangerous for the, you know, if they're afraid that their body or that the cemetery will be disrespected, then maybe you would do it.
Mistake is made, you bury in the wrong place.
That's a question. Can you do it then? I had that question once also.
Well, that book I gave you.
What?
Repeat the question?
Yeah.
Someone was buried in the wrong plot.
Oh.
The family had a bunch of plots and the funeral home made a mistake.
So, let's say that person who owns that plot says, "No, this is my plot. I want to be buried next to my wife."
Right.
Get him out.
It happened to me. I bought a plot in Guinea.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. We had a plot for about 2-3 years. Get a phone call. Choose another place. Somebody was there already.
Somebody was there already? Wow. Hi. You don't want that.
You did, you know, Bob? Bob?
Bob.
Suspect.
Of course, yeah.
And I said to you, I said, how could that be? I said, I happen to know the person who's in there.
Can you talk to him? Talk to him for me? All right. All right, let's just discuss a few things that happen around burial and around the funeral, just to get a little perspective on it. So the first thing, what you're supposed to say when you hear someone dies, is Baruch Dayan HaEmes, right? Blessed be the true judge, right? When you hear someone dies, that's the Jewish response, right? It's a way of saying, you know, Hashem's a true judge, and we don't always understand it, but we accept it. Right? And a person for a loved one is supposed to say the same thing. There's a, you know, blessing I said also at the funeral, but that's something that someone's supposed to say right away. When a person passes away, so the family members are in a status called aninut, or aninus. Okay, it's this limbo state before burial, before mourning. They're not quite in mourning yet. And if you've ever been around a person who has a family member who passed away, but they're not buried yet, they're in a really weird, it's a really weird place. You feel like you're in limbo. I mean, the funeral is supposed to offer a certain sense of closure, but a person really can't, move on to the next stage of mourning until that happens. That's typically, how it is. Which is one of the reasons that Judaism is so focuses on trying to bury as quickly as possible, as a sign of respect to the body. As we saw, we're not supposed to leave the body overnight. We're supposed to show as much respect to the body as we can. And in Jerusalem, they take this to the extreme. They will always try to bury the same day, if possible. Very often.
And to die at midnight, you'd be buried by 4 a.m.
No, they won't bury it in the middle of the night. No, they won't do that. No. They'll just wait to the day. But it's the custom of Jerusalem to bury very quickly. And so sometimes, there's been situations that are very sad of like their parents or siblings like in another country in America, and they have a child who lives in Israel or something, and they're buried there and the parents can't get there in time. It does result in modern times in some very sad situations, but they bury right away. So it is a sign of respect, and it also helps the family, kind of begin to cope and to have closure. The body before it's buried is given a tahara, right? It's given a what's it called? It's given a what? It's not a preparation, I would say.
Like embalming, or
no.
I don't mean embalming. But what is it? What do they do?
Basically, the body. It's like going to a mikveh, right? You basically go through the process of going to a mikveh. The body is prepared as if a person was going to a mikveh, and they are, like sprinkled, with water, as if they went to a mikveh. Okay, so that's basically what it is. It's like a purifying process. There's a physical element to it, but it's mostly a spiritual concept. So you physically prepare the body as if there. So I won't get into the details, but it's the same basic process. So that's done before the
would they talus on the body or anything like that?
There's different customs with that. Some people do, some people don't. Yeah. Either way. Yeah. Some people will be buried with their talus. So yeah, there's different customs. okay. So the funeral itself, like we said, the most important aspect of the funeral first is the eulogies that are given, which, as we saw, is a very important mitzvah and the ultimate sign of respect. And there's a lot of conversation, a lot of discussion about when does the soul fully leave this earth, right? And there are some opinions that the soul has a hard time leaving the body, right? And in some ways, the more a person view themselves as a body, the harder time the soul has fully leaving it, right? It has a hard time adjusting to life without a body, seeing itself, right? Some people just can't see themselves as a soul. They can't see the soul as their essence, and so there is a state of limbo, not just for the mourners, but for the soul, that the soul might linger a bit, and the soul might linger through the funeral, hopefully not beyond, right? Then you're in ghost territory, right? That's a whole other thing. So I don't believe in ghosts forever, but there is a concept of the soul lingering, for a short amount of time.
How about if the soul changes mind and goes back?
Doesn't have that choice. Doesn't have that power.
No,
it's not given that power. But it is, I think about it a little bit when I give a eulogy. I do think about, maybe the soul is listening. So that is a part of this as well.
Very hard to accept when someone passes away, especially if you are very close to that person. It's very difficult.
Oh, for sure. No, it's nothing more permanent than that.
No.
Yeah. So that's the essence of it, and then the rest, you know, the body is taken to the burial plot and buried, and then we have a custom, again, as a sign of respect, that everybody helps bury the person. So everyone who wants to can, you know, the way you would do, there's a pile of dirt and there's a shovel, and people can all take turns helping bury them as a sign of respect. Now the Shiva. So the Shiva is for 7 days. But the first day of Shiva being the day the person passes away. Okay? So the day the person is buried. The day of the funeral. So, if the funeral is on a Monday, then the Shiva lasts until the next Sunday. Okay? Shabbat counts as one of the 7 days of Shiva. But because Shabbat is a day where we're not supposed to be mourning, we don't fast, we don't mourn on Shabbat. So, you're not supposed to have public displays of mourning, but you can have private displays of mourning. So, for example, read my notes here. So, public displays of mourning include wearing one's head garment. A mourner doesn't wear leather shoes, but that you would do. You know, mourner, you know, wears a ripped clothing because it's a mitzvah. A person passes away to. For the mourners to rip, I don't know, clothing is a sign of mourning, but to keep that, the whole Shiva, to always be wearing something that's torn. But we don't do that on Shabbos, because that's a public sign of mourning. So they should act normally on Shabbos, publicly, but privately, they should still have the aspects of mourning. So they shouldn't, you know, be bathing, they should sit in lower chairs. They shouldn't learn Torah, which we'll get to. So all these things that are more private, they should still not do. But they go to shul. They should still go to shul. They should still be around. But it's still counts as one of the days of mourning, but it's kind of in between. Now, if one of the Yom Tovim come, it's different. So let's say a person passes away and they're buried the day before Pesach. Okay? So what about Pesach? So the way it works is, the festivals, the Yom Tovim, are considered to be such days of joy that that the mourning and that joy cannot coexist. So the festivals trump the mourning, and the person's Shiva is cut short. So if a person sits Shiva at all before Yom Tov, once Yom Tov begins, the Shiva's over. There's no more. So if a person, you know, buries a relative. Now, let me go back a step. The only relatives a person sits Shiva for are spouses, siblings, children, and parents. Only direct relatives. So, no grandparents, no aunts and uncles, no cousins,
no friends,
no, you know, ex-husbands or ex-wives.
What if your Rebbe dies?
No, you don't sit Shiva.
What?
No.
If you're a Rebbe.
Oh.
No, you don't sit Shiva. Only for, I guess they're called direct relatives, or first, what's the word for that?
Direct
relatives? Is that
immediate family.
Immediate family, that's better. Yeah, immediate family. Only for immediate family. Now, it's not that you can't help out, it's not that you can't be around, right? Or for in-laws, for example. You can certainly sit Shiva with them and be part of it, but you're not obligated in all these things. Yeah. And typically, you're more helpful if you're not sitting Shiva.
About either Yom Kippur or Rosh Hashanah.
Same thing.
Same thing. No. Shiva.
Yeah, Shiva is completely. Even though Yom Kippur is one day, and you still in theory have 5 more days after the Shiva, and once the Yom Tov comes, it destroys the Shiva.
Like 2 days Rosh Hashanah. It's usually 2 days away.
Yeah. Doesn't matter. Yeah, but no matter how many days the Chag is, once the you hit that chag, the person's Shiva is over completely. It ends. And then you move on to a 30-day period called Shloshim. The 30-day period is a period where you're still obligated to say Kaddish. Okay? Now you say Kaddish for a parent for 11 months, but for other family members in the immediate family, you'd say it for a month. You're obligated to shave for a month. So that's what happens in Shloshim. Not supposed to shave. It's basically what you consider like the 3 weeks. I'm sorry, the 9 days kind of mourning. So you don't go to concerts and you don't, you know, take hot showers. You're supposed to have like a level of mourning, but less severe than previous. Not seeing Shiva anymore. So the same thing applies to Shloshim. So let's say someone has a funeral 8 days before
Erev
Pesach.
Yom Kippur.
What?
Erev Yom Kippur.
No, we did Erev Yom Kippur. But a person is 8 days before.
Erev Yom Kippur is Shiva. It's canceled when Sukkot comes. The Shloshim.
Oh, okay. We can do that too. Okay, fine. So basically, once your Shiva ends, now you're in Shloshim. If you hit any of the Jewish holidays in Shloshim, then Shloshim ends there as well. So if, for example, a person dies a day before Pesach, the funeral is the day before Pesach, so then the funeral happens before Pesach, they say Shiva for a little bit of time, and then Pesach ends the Shiva. After Pesach, they start their Shloshim. But if the funeral was 8 days before Pesach, and the Shiva ended before Pesach, and then they had 1 day of Shloshim, it was 30 days, Pesach would knock that out completely. The 11th month, the child observes for their parent. That's never knocked out by anything. That the full 11 months is always observed, and during those 11 months, the child is supposed to say Kaddish for their parents, you know, every day, three times a day. With three minions, and they're not supposed to go to things that are overtly joyous. So they're not supposed to go to concerts or to really festive environments, right?
Where music is.
Especially places where live music is. So weddings, you're not supposed to go to weddings. If they go to a wedding, they can go to the chuppah, but not to the actual ceremony, unless they're working at it. There's kind of some workarounds that you know, like what if you have a child who's getting married, and you know, someone's parent passes away a month before the wedding. So obviously, you're gonna, so then the whole thing they have to be. If they work there, it's okay. So they have a job. It's so there's some workarounds, but conceptually, you know, you try to avoid it.
How about Hanukkah? Is that would be considered because it's 8 days of Hanukkah?
Yeah. Well, it's a good question because Hanukkah. Hanukkah would not interrupt it, would not end the Shiva, neither would Purim, because they're not Torah holidays.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm trying to think, on Hanukkah, would you show a lesser form of... would you show a lesser...
But Rosh Chodesh does stop it.
No, Rosh Chodesh does not. I don't remember, I have to check Hanukkah, I don't remember. Good question. Okay, now who do you sit Shiva for? Okay, so we talked about immediate relatives, converts. Someone who converts to Judaism does not sit Shiva for their parents if their parents are not, you know, are not Jewish. So
even
can
if
mourn,
they convert,
even if they convert, right? You're not considered to be halachically connected in that same way. So, yeah. So you obviously can mourn your parents and do whatever. You know, however you want to do it, but saying Shiva, formally, you know, a person wouldn't do.
Do they say Kaddish?
They would not say Kaddish, unless they want to say Kaddish for someone else and have them in mind, you could, but to say Kaddish just for them, typically is not done. No. So a few customs about saying Shiva. We have candles, we light a candle that's there for the entire 7 days of the Shiva. You're not supposed to learn Torah on Shabbos, because that's supposed to bring a person joy. So just like on Tisha B'Av, we don't learn Torah, unless things that are kind of a little bit more depressing. So same thing you would do on when you sit Shiva. Married couples should not be together during Shiva. During Shiva, you should limit, you know, taking hot showers or try not to do anything like that. Should, you know, not take, you know, do it in the ways that are not too enjoyable. Not supposed to get haircuts, not supposed to cut your nails, not supposed to shave.
Can you do those things to prepare for Shabbat, though?
Yeah, so if getting ready for Shabbat, you can do some of those things. Yeah, you can do a little bit more. Not a haircut, but, and you're not supposed to get a haircut or shave. You may trim a little bit if you need to, but you can, you know, you can shower a little bit more. You're not supposed to do laundry or wear laundry clothes, again, just like the 9 days before Tisha B'Av. You're not supposed to wear leather shoes. There's a custom to cover your mirrors in a Shiva house. So why is that? So one reason given, which is a pretty good reason, by the Pnei Baruch, who's wrote one of the, you know, key books for laws of mourning and laws of burial. So he says, because mirrors are a symbol of vanity, and so it's inappropriate for a person to be thinking about their vanity at a time like that. It's considered to be inappropriate.
All that pictures.
Some people cover pictures as well. Many don't, but some people have the custom. That's based on custom.
Is that custom or?
Yeah, it's custom. Even mirrors is a custom. Even covering mirrors is a custom.
Even mirrors is a custom.
Yeah, I believe it's a more Ashkenazi custom than a Sephardi custom. I think so. I don't think Spartans have the same custom in the same way. But yeah, I mean, as far as all things done in the Shiva house, in most Ashkenazi families, covering the mirrors is the first thing they do.
Yeah, the first thing they do.
Right, that's the first thing they do. So, yeah. As you said,
I'll bet pictures.
Yeah, I think pictures are fine. Most people don't cover pictures. Yeah. But we said how customs become sometimes even more important than law. So covering mirrors is a custom, but it's become like, it's a big deal.
Well, you can argue halakha, but hey, I'm doing it because that's the way my family's always done it.
You can't argue with that.
You can't argue with that.
You argue, but it's a good point. It's a good point. Yeah. Any questions? No? Okay.
Thank you very much.